Tonight I want to talk about sex and intimacy. And so even when I say sex and intimacy is the topic, I think it's interesting just to notice what that feels like to be talking about sex in front of a group. Definitely feels a little bit uncomfortable for me. I think mostly that's because we live in a time, place, a culture that on one hand we have this really strange dichotomy where we glorify sex, and it's kind of everywhere. I mean, you can't really be, it's changing a little bit, but you can't really be an actor or an actress or a music artist without having some sex appeal. All over advertisements, tan, abs, bodies, flesh, less clothes, people having sex, love. There's a sex scene in about every movie. And so on one hand, we glorify sex, but on the other hand, we refuse to talk about it. And so it creates this for myself, and I think I work in many fields of treatment, addiction treatment, sex addiction, love addiction, addiction. From a Buddhist perspective, we all have addiction to some degree. And what I see is that on one hand we have this sexual desire, which can be really powerful. And also we can feel very confused and almost under-resourced with how to work with it. Right, especially all the sexual stimulation and how much sex is in our face, but then not talking about it creates a sense of not really having the tools or the resources to deal with this very human sexual desire that we have kind of born in. I mean, after all, it's how we got here, right? And it can sometimes be seen as like sinful or bad, or it's definitely awkward to talk about for me, vulnerable. Also, most of us have experienced some harm around sex, so that's another good reason to talk about sex, is that especially in our community, Against the Stream serves a demographic of a lot of folks in recoveries of different types, and most folks with addiction, a higher percentage would have sexual trauma or sexual abuse. Many of us have been abused or have caused harm ourselves, have sought validation, have sought pleasure through sex, through intimacy, through praise. On the societal level also, a lot of harm around just the idea of what's feminine and what's masculine, these two. Anytime, basically, I'm kind of seeing in my practice, like, anytime there are just two things, it's like you're getting the story wrong, right? Anytime my mind's black and white, this or that, or it's this way or that way. And last week I talked about this self and other that happens a lot, the sense of I am this, I am the norm, you are the other, vice versa, right? Because life is very much gray. Stephen Batchelor is a Dharma teacher, and he's quoted, he talks about that there are no lines in nature, you know, and so we draw these lines, and so what's feminine, what looks good, you know, what's the type of body that's feminine, what is the feminine submissive, it's the dominant masculine, even for men, having to perform in the sense of you have to be the courter, the one to go get. And so there's a lot of harm in these dynamics, both in acting out these dynamics and being born into a world where these dynamics are already kind of placed on us. Buddhist communities constantly struggle with sex. Sex scandals rampant, just like most religions. You could probably find sex scandals. And I think it's because we don't talk about it. I think that when it really comes down to it, we have no transparency and we don't talk about it. And being in a position where you're teaching like I am right now, if you don't talk about it, boundaries kind of dissolve and harm can be caused really easily. For myself, it's uncomfortable to talk about sex, mostly because I learned about sex from friends and from watching pornography when I was like 13 or 14 years old. I was one of the younger people of my friends to be sexually active, and so I mostly felt like sex was an area that I explored alone, either alone by myself or with other uninstructed sexual partners that I had at a young age. And so it became really quickly kind of a quiet, really weird, awkward, uncomfortable area. So the Buddha asked us to consider sexuality as a part of our Buddhist practice. Part of what is missing from, this is all my opinion, but part of what is missing from secular mindfulness practice is the ethical foundation of Buddhism. So if you're just aware of thoughts, feelings, and emotions, and objective, and watching all of the stressful patterns and the ways that we trip out, it's not very helpful if we don't do anything to change those patterns, if we don't have some structure around kind of an ethical base, ethical training. This is called sila. The Buddha said that sexual desire is so powerful, if there was another desire as strong as sexual desire that existed in this realm of human experience, that no one could awaken. He said, if there were two of these that existed, you'd be fucked. And so he, for monastics, for monks, people that really, really, really wanted to take on this path with some vigor and with some dedication, he said, you know, if you really want to, just don't mess with it. He said, you can become celibate. That's an option. So I like to say that because Buddhism often is about taking ownership and responsibility for the ways that I think, act, speak. And so if we engage in sex, part of that territory comes with this strong attachment, a lot of insecurity and fear, abandonment, betrayal, also joy. I tend to focus on the other stuff first because that's why I'm here, but also joy and connection and love and commitment. So in Buddhist practice, this ethical foundation, normally, ordinarily, we take on what's called the Buddhist training precepts. And I like this because the Buddha didn't, and in none of his teaching, or he didn't in any of his teaching really imply that anything was good or bad. If you read through the discourses, the Buddha's never saying this is good or bad. He usually says something like this is wholesome or unwholesome, this is skillful or not skillful. So what he's pointing towards is that all of these practices around sexuality, around ethical foundation, non-harming, are practices. It's not about good or bad or sinful or right or wrong. It's just about what causes well-being and a meaningful life, what helps you find awakening, more clarity, and then what's getting in the way. So as we do this, as lay practitioners, meaning non-monks, the monks have like 300 or something rules, so if you want to do that, that's cool. We got five, not rules, but training precepts. And all of them, in short, if you don't remember all of them, that's fine. In short, basically, the five precepts, this ethical foundation is based in non-harming. That's kind of the, just very simply, we want to practice non-harming in our action, in our speech, in our thoughts. The first precept is to abstain or to refrain from intentionally causing harm to any living beings. And most often this is called refraining from killing, but I like this broader, intentionally causing harm. The second is to refrain from taking that which is not freely offered. You could say refrain from stealing, but I like the way that it's kind of originally translated is taking what's not freely offered, because a lot of times people's time and attention, and there are things that I rob from people all the time that's not really being freely offered, and so to be conscious of that. So intentionally causing harm, not taking what's freely offered, to refrain from unwise or unskillful speech, which is a category of its own, and he elaborates a lot on that, and to refrain from sexual misconduct, and to refrain from intoxicating drinks and drugs that lead to heedlessness. And so all the Buddha really says, it's really interesting, he doesn't really elaborate much on what he means by sexual misconduct. He says a couple things, mostly to abstain from engaging in sexual activity with people that aren't consenting to sexual activity. And so we could talk for quite some time about what consent is and what that means. He also included this category with minors or with people that are not of age to consent, which we could talk about also, some gray areas. He also said to refrain from sex with people that are in committed relationships. I like how Thich Nhat Hanh frames this the other way. A lot of times if you look at these lists of ethical practices, the Buddha will always frame things as abstaining. And I like this because what he's kind of pointing towards for me is it means that the Dharma is a subtractive rather than an additive practice, which means that I'm letting go of things that are getting in the way of my happiness rather than having to do things that I don't inherently have to make myself happy. All right, so I like abstaining, but I like what Thich Nhat Hanh says about not engaging in committed sexual relationships. He says making a vow to protect relationships. And so just seeing that people that are committed, that we want to support them in being committed. And if I'm in a committed relationship, I want to support the well-being of that relationship. He also said, please don't fuck my monks or my nuns. Don't have sex with the people that are my disciples. I would really appreciate it. They're celibate. And so again, these are all just trainings. It's not so much, I don't feel like anyone would be isolated or ostracized. Actually, why they came up with the monastic code is because monks and nuns broke these rules all the time. And so they're like, okay, we have to set some ground rules if we're going to try to awaken. It helps to live in a way that promotes awakening. So why are we motivated to have sex? I think this is important. I think really this is where the investigation of our sexual conduct and intimacy, where this starts to take place as we start looking at our motivations. One of the first categories of ways I'd say we're sexually motivated is just sex for the sake of pleasure, sex for the sake of sex. Which I don't think is inherently good or bad. I think that it can be nice and pleasurable and joyful. I'm mostly talking about sex outside of committed relationships. So these are the friends with benefits or the stranger or the hookup. We just seek sex to have sex. These types of relationships, my sense is that it takes an immense amount of respect and communication to uphold. More often than not, in my experience, and the people that I work close with, and the people that I am in community with, is that these types of relationships, more often than not, usually end up in someone feeling rejected, in feelings of being used and some forms of harm. A lot of times, seeking sex just for the sake of sex, I know for myself, could be a way to experience pleasure without having to deal with the emotional weight of feelings. But this is kind of an arrogant way to try to divorce intimacy from sex, which I think can be possible, but is really hard. And I don't know if it's very fruitful. Another problem is that attachment's very strong, and so I think it can kind of be arrogant, too, to just seek sex for the sake of sex, because whether we agree in the beginning, friends with benefits, no conditions, no strings attached, those things change. And so I have been in relationship with people where I've had friends with benefits, and maybe it's worked out once. And when it changed, we communicated, we held it with respect, and then we stopped. But it's really hard to navigate. Another motivation, deeper motivations would be something along the lines of, I want to feel loved, I want to feel connection, I want to start a family. These aren't usually conscious, these are just a bunch of motivations we have. We also have motivations because of loneliness to seek sex and intimacy, because of we got out of one relationship and are feeling the loss and rejection, so we go to ex people or other people to try to fill that type of comfort. And so whether it's love or feeling connected or loneliness or feeling rejected, these motivations are mixed, and so it's always really helpful to talk about sex, which is usually the last thing we want to do, so we can get some clarity around where we're at and what our intentions are for ourselves and for others. Another reason why we would get involved in sexual relationships is for the flip side of this, for intimacy, connection, and maybe committed relationships. And so I put this in big umbrella. This could be monogamous, this could be just different, but committed relationships where there are agreements, where there's an understanding, where it's clear, where there's some guidelines. So there are a couple folks, psychologists, Badner and Pearson, that talk about the stages of intimacy when you engage in a relationship and when you engage in a sexual relationship, when you start agreeing that you're going to come together with someone and be intimate. We go through stages. I think they're kind of helpful to overview, although I don't think they're black and white. The first stage is what we would all call the honeymoon stage, or infatuation. They also call it exclusive bonding. That sounds very psychological, exclusive bonding. This is the love drunk stage. This is where pursuit and receiving of attraction and intimacy feels really good. It can be actually very intoxicating, and a lot of folks in this stage can have a sense that this is what love is, this feeling, because it feels good. A lot of fantasy, a lot of idealizing, and I'm not trying to speak too negatively. I think this is just a natural, normal part of coming together at the beginning of a relationship. Usually what I'm in love with is the idea of who I think you are, and then I get to know you and you come into the second stage, which is called landing, or where you start to develop power struggle, psychologically maybe differentiating. So in the first stage, there's usually a lot of sex, there's a lot of attraction, there's a lot of fulfillment on both ends, because both partners are still idealized in a big way. You come into the second stage and you start to see how neurotic your partner is, and he or she smells, or they smell, they don't always say the right thing, so on and so forth. During this time, you start to see person's flaws and character traits. Sex and closeness become more mediocre or actually absent in some cases. Right, so it's all a spectrum. It's not necessarily black and white. Some couples do really well with the landing period, and it's very short, and move on to the third, which is practicing creating the partnership. So this is really, I think, in Buddhist practice, the stage that stages 3, 4, and 5 are the stages that we're really trying to move ourselves towards. So this stage is emphasizing practicing. It's where you focus on teamwork. So you talk about sex, you talk about intimacy and your individual needs. This is where usually passiveness or blaming, those two extremes that we find ourselves in, you could probably put yourself in one of these categories. I'm the passive, some people are more the blaming, where that kind of stops the teamwork from coming together, or usually we come up against some of that, our tendencies around that. So we work together, practicing creating the partnership, and then the fourth stage is reconnecting, where the relationship and intimacy deepen and it becomes exciting again. If you've been married, I watched my parents go through this, where they would separate and they came back together and there was a deepening of their relationship. Now they eventually got divorced, but there was still this stage of coming together and deepening. This is the stage where you feel, okay, this maybe will work out. We just went through some shit, right? Then the fifth stage, which I think is where we mostly want to land in Buddhist practice, is where what we would call equanimity comes into fruition, where we have mutual interdependence. Each partner feels supported and safe to explore their individual interests because they know ultimately they are loved, they're trusted, respected by their partner. Sex is good. It doesn't mean it's more frequent or more passionate or whatever, but it's good. It's stable because we know what we want, we know how to ask for it, and we know how to deal effectively with differences in desire. So we know how to practice generosity and love, and sacrifice. And so I think this is important both if you're in a relationship and if we're not, because if we're not in a relationship, I know for myself, oftentimes I feel loneliness, I feel at times this sense of reaching out as if I will be happy when I get the connection. I mean, this is one of the most primal of desires I have, is to be connected, to be in love, to be loved. Loneliness can be a really big trigger for what, I don't know a better word for it, maladjusted sexual behavior, doing shit that doesn't make us feel good ultimately, the short term. I was talking to a friend and talking as we were hashing it out, I heard that, you know, like loneliness is really, it's a feeling, it's an emotion that basically wants to be tended to, right? Because if I feel alone, I want to have something to connect with. And usually what I do is I search externally for the cause of soothing this. But in heart practice, meditation, and Buddhist practice, as we start to open to our loneliness and sit with it and feel it, we can start to empathetically care for it. And if you care for your loneliness, it will diminish over time. It's the long route, it's not the short route, but I've found that it does, and it builds in more of a sense of refuge, more of a sense of confidence that we can be alone, and then our relationships don't tend to be as volatile and codependent, and, you know, y'all know, I know. So feeling loneliness is important. It's important to consider that even in relationship, these ebbs and flows continue. So intention from a Buddhist perspective, one of the ways to work with sexuality is to look at our intentions. One of the path factors of the Eightfold Path is wise or appropriate, skillful intention is how we practice with our intention. I think the greatest defeat of ourselves, the greatest way that we defeat ourselves, is self-deception, self-dishonesty. This is when we don't have good community, we don't have good awareness, and we continue to rationalize and justify not knowing a lot of times, and we get way down the road into a relationship or into something, some form of behavior really spirals out of control, and then we feel isolated, we feel alone, and then we don't want to connect back, we feel shame. And so really the first thing we can start to do is start to be really honest with ourselves. the three intentions that we want to practice are the intention of non-harming is the first one. Again, this is similar to the precepts that we talked about before. But looking at the underlying intention in the thought, mind, and the heart before we act, what are our intentions, what are our motivations? Non-harming requires a lot of honesty and communication. My friend Kate Spina, she was here a little while ago, she is does a really wonderful job talking about sex in Buddhism, sex in the Dharma. I don't know if she adapted this, but I'm stealing it from her. She talks about ways of developing non-harming by listing out all of the ways we engage in sexual behavior. So from the internal thoughts, lusts, fantasies, who they are, where it happens the most, to the ways we act in sexual behavior, masturbation, pornography, sexual acts that we do with our friends. And so we list all of these things out, and we label from 1 to 10, from the least harm to the most harm on each one. So you say, well, this one's about a 6, this one's about a 3, this one's a 9, this one's a 2. And to commit to one of them in the beginning, to look at, if you want to really look into non-harming for ourselves and for others, to look at maybe starting to practice some, which is the second intention, renunciation, or some letting go of some of these non-harming, or some of these more harmful behaviors. Maybe we would first start small and just keep it with that. I want to set an intention to be less lustful when I go to the gym, to watch my mind. That's one of the places where lust happens for me most often, being really vulnerable. The beach, the gym, right? If this is somewhere where you regularly go. So you set that intention. You say, well, this is causing me actually a lot of harm for some reason. It really spirals me, which it doesn't for me, but it really spirals me into obsession, and it really ruins my day. And so that's about an 8 or a 9, or maybe it's about a 3 or a 4. Start small and just keep with one. And we start practicing renunciation, letting go of some of these maybe less harmful, maybe more harmful. Renunciation is letting go. It's letting go for the point. Sometimes they call it the joy of renunciation. It doesn't sound like fun, but what comes when I let go of something that's causing me harm is actually more well-being. It's strange. It's usually not an easy practice, but we all know when we finally let go of some shit that we needed to let go of, eventually we feel better, right? And so in letting go, we can start to see that sexual energy is just energy. And I don't mean like metaphysical or shooting out of your eyes and limbs energy. What I mean is just the energetic feeling of emotion, the pull, the desire, the craving, you know, is just craving. It's just a felt feeling, a sense in the nervous system, just like as we sit and we meditate and we try to hold still and you feel the itch and you make a decision, I'm not going to scratch the itch, I'm going to sit through it and watch it change and move and maybe it will go away. We can do this, start to do that, use this with bigger cravings. Shanti Deva said, in learning to sit with small annoyances, I can be with these bigger areas of suffering or craving, obsession. So we maybe take a harm reduction approach. So I'm speaking to also just maybe we just say, okay, I really can't do this thing because every time I do this thing, it's really bad for me. So I can still do this thing or this other thing, but I'm just going to stop doing this one, right? Sometimes we can be really black and white. I think that can also be good. So I'm going to speak to the other end. We can take the harm reduction. I think also it's really good to at times try to practice periods of celibacy. It's, if you're in a committed relationship, your partner will probably hate me, and I wouldn't recommend just saying, all right, I'm not going to masturbate. I'm not going to have sex. I'm not going to engage in sexual activity. I've done this for periods of time, and I found it to be really helpful, just like we put aside our stress and all of the plans for the period of meditation so we can then get some space and be able to watch the mind and what it's obsessed with and what it's doing and put that down. Same thing when we take a period of time of celibacy or take a period of time letting go of any of these behaviors, we gain enough space to where we can see how we want to either integrate it back into our lives or do away with it altogether. If you are taking periods of celibacy from all sexual activity, you'll probably want some support. That's all I'll say about that. Also, I'll just say, I think this can be helpful too. Maybe even some of us taking periods of celibacy from relationships in general. I think this can be helpful. I know I'm not, I have the tendency to avoid relationships for the longest time. I really wanted nothing to do with them. So that's one of the extremes, right? The Dharma, the Buddha's path is often referred to as the middle path. So like I said, anytime we get these polarized views, we want to shoot somewhere for the middle. So some of us have more of a repressed sense of sexuality, would rather avoid it and not engage it because it makes us so activated or insecure, is very fearful. And so if that's the tendency, your edge wants to be to maybe date more, to investigate more into connecting, into emotionally connecting, developing intimacy. Also, some folks that I know have a tendency to hop from one relationship to another relationship to another relationship. If that's your case, it may be helpful to stop for a period of time. Usually I like the whole 90-day suggestion. Stop for 90 days, reevaluate with a mentor, with a friend, and then maybe reconvene. In the last, so we have non-harming, we have renunciation as intention. The last is an intention of goodwill. I think in order to practice goodwill, which is basically kindness with it, it doesn't necessarily mean we can't be rough if we like rough sex, or we can't be wild, freaky people. I think that it means that we want to clearly communicate how we feel and be willing to talk about sex and to be willing to consider that this other being that we're with equally has important needs and wants, and that if those should change, we need to negotiate and we need to find a common ground. So a way to keep these intentions is to, I like to take the precepts every day. I don't really talk about this much, but it's become much more of a important part of my practice for the longest time, actually probably until not too long ago. If you asked me if I was Buddhist, I would probably stare at you and wouldn't have an answer. But I'm starting to feel more and more confident as time goes on that taking refuge and saying out loud and participating in some ritual can be a really helpful reminder that I'm committed to this path and that it's worked and that I have faith in it, and so I'll continue to practice. So you can look up the refuges, you could get with me, I could give you a copy or send you a copy of the refuges, but they're really helpful to remind ourselves. Sometimes I'll adopt them, so if I'm practicing celibacy from masturbation, maybe when I get to the sexual misconduct, I'll say, I vow to undertake the training precept to refrain from sexual misconduct and to refrain from masturbation for today. Right? It's a commitment to myself. This is similar, you see maybe in four agreements. Making an agreement with yourself can be really powerful. Resolutions and intention can be really powerful. So taking the training precepts help us keep intention. Also, mindfulness itself is really helpful for sexuality and working with sexuality. It's helpful to notice what is lust, what's sexual desire. So when I feel a sense of craving or sexual desire, to kind of investigate it, what is it? I would think, sexual desire, it sounds pretty pleasant to me, but oftentimes, depending upon the situation, oftentimes sexual desire is actually very unpleasant and very frustrating. And so if you are willing to investigate it and to see when I'm thinking about sex on my way into work, that it is not going to help me out at all if I continue to ruminate. And so one of the meditations that Buddhist monks do is they do a body contemplation where they'll break from this first cycle of intimacy where we get infatuated or lustful or engaged in fantasy, and they start to start to move into the second stage of landing into the reality. And so what they do is they'll contemplate the body as it actually is. This person's body is really composed of skin and blood and pus and sinew and bile, and it smells and it defecates, and it's funny, but it actually really helps. I won't share that. Okay, so that can be really helpful to contemplate, to consider the nature of the body. I mean, ultimately, in reality. And you see this as you get older. If you talk to older couples, sexuality changes over the lifespan too, and the dynamic changes. What we want and what we feel aroused by and what we feel interested in will change. And so, you know, and it's a more mature understanding, I think. And if you're sexually active, I think that you shouldn't, before you're about to have sex, contemplate the body in this way. So last thing I'll say is equanimity. So part of if there is a goal of meditation, if there is a goal of Dharma practice, I would say it's this summed up in this word equanimity. Equanimity in Pali Sanskrit, the word's upekka, and what it means is there in the middleness. What that means is basically trying to have a balanced response to life as it ebbs and flows and changes. So being able to be responsive and being able to take responsibility for our part. So if I'm pissed off, I'll just use that as an example, a different feeling, emotion. If I'm resentful, if I'm pissed off, what's happening if I tend to chew on the resentment as I do, I at least want to take responsibility for my feelings. So saying something to myself like, wow, I'm really angry, I'm really pissed off, I'm really frustrated. What I tend to do instead is I tend to say, you did this, they did that. If they wouldn't have done that, I wouldn't have done this. But by taking responsibility for our emotions and what we're feeling and experiencing, there's a lot of liberation, because the more we can take responsibility, the more we can see that so certain things cause suffering, and we can start to internally let them go. We like to let go, but we don't oftentimes like to let in. So if you take responsibility, you own and you feel what's happening, so you can feel where it causes stress and suffering, and then you will internally let it go. Because if you really know how painful something is, I believe you'll let it go. But it's when we keep ourselves at bay from our pain with rationalizing and with blaming and justifying, we don't let go. And so equanimity requires us to take responsibility. This is also important in our relationships, that we take responsibility, one, for the fact that if we're going to be in them, we're going to have pain. If we're going to be in them, we're going to cause harm. If we're going to be in them, it'll probably be good to start to speak to our partner about sex, to speak to our partner about intimacy, to ask for forgiveness, to be humble. Also, in the guise of equanimity, to also take responsibility for setting limits with people. This is really important with relationships and sexual relationships, that actually you are completely, have complete permission to not participate, and to say no, to say even if I fear I might harm the person's feelings, or by setting limits it will be awkward or uncomfortable. It's very necessary and important to explore our edge with saying no and saying what we need and saying what our limits are. Otherwise, people won't know. In situations where this isn't possible, and we'll need support, and we'll need people around us that know of resources and how to connect and find safety, and that's important to say too. So, I'm sweating a little bit. We made it through it. I would love to hear. We have plenty of time. We have 15 minutes for discussion and dialogue. You can also ask questions. The floor is open. Thank you.